Sorry, hands up anyone who hasn't got an ice cream. Because it seems like there's been a pretty big queue out there, right? Never mind. I don't know how long they're going to keep going for, but I guess that's why there's been a bit of a delay for a few folks coming in. Did anyone see the session we did before lunch? Just a quick show of hands, if I could. Okay, so do we really need... I suppose we should just quickly introduce ourselves for those folks who haven't turned up before. My name's David Caddick. This is Rick Mack. We're both from Quest Software. Oops, I haven't pressed that twice. There we go. The reason why I call up the contact details is just because I've already run out of business cards. Rick's still got a few. Feel free to ask questions at the end. But again, if there's any specific questions, details about your environments, etc., that you want to have a bit of a chat about, or any design ideas, please feel free to come and approach us afterwards. I'm quite happy to take your business card, etc., and contact you straight back as far as having a conversation around that. So, Rick, at one stage, was the Citrix technical professional for APJ before he decided to join another company, Provision Networks, before it got swallowed up by Quest. So between Rick and myself, my previous life, I've sort of worked for Citrix and HP thin clients for a while, and before that, a Citrix Platinum partner in the UK for a number of years, and also Citibank. So between us, I think we have something like 30-odd years' worth of experience in this sort of area, specifically more around RDSH and those elements. And to a certain extent, we've been lucky enough to have Server 2012 code for probably the best part of, about 3 weeks or so for the RTM, right?
Yeah,
about that. So we've dived into it, and we've tried to gather up not just that information, but information from our colleagues. One of our colleagues, Rob Malicote, actually works on the Redmond campus over in Seattle. So between that, we've gathered as much information as we can. We've presented it here. Do be aware as we head into this, there may be bits missing. There may be bits that are not complete, and I'll take full responsibility for that. I'm the one who did the slide deck to start with. Rick did review it, okay, but I'm not blaming him. It's all mine, okay? But look, if there is anything missing or you do want to call out other questions, feel free to call them out, etc., and let's see how we go from there. So without further ado, let's head into it. Do be aware that Server 2012, they have changed a few things, as is wont to do, and I guess this is very much from a marketing sense as much as anything else. It's now being referred to, from a VDI perspective, VDI is now being referred to as pooled and personal, i.e. non-persistent and then persistent. Mind you, having said that, sometimes there's far too many Ps there, and I very quickly get it mistaken. There is also elements of user profile disk and user environment virtualization. We've had some interesting bits where we've already been doing user environment virtualization or elements of that with meta profiles in vWorkspace prior. So to a certain extent, I know that we would like to sort of call our hand up and say, I think Microsoft might just have copied us a little bit on that. Do you think, Rick?
No. Microsoft never copy anyone.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Good call. All right. There is also some more options in storage. I don't think we really need to cover too much in storage. That's pretty much been covered by other sessions, etc. The one element that I have heard great reports about as far as storage virtualization, or storage, I should say, in Server 2012 is the fact of SMB3. So it certainly makes a huge amount of difference, night and day, between the storage elements in the back. So, as I say, I think that's been pretty much covered off by other sessions, so we won't cover off too much. And then we'll start diving into and focusing a lot more on remote effects and what its capabilities are. Did you want to have a couple of cents there, Rick? Or?
Yeah, most of you probably know remote effects basically arose from Microsoft's acquisition of a company called Calista. And Calista actually represented a bit of a problem for Microsoft at first because it was poor. It ran on VMware. But what Calista had was GPU virtualization, and they had a fairly interesting screen scraping technology for giving you generic multimedia delivery. That basically came out in RDP 7, RemoteFX, and The nice thing about RemoteFX was the capabilities on Session Host were actually greater than the capabilities on VDI, from the viewpoint that on VDI you needed a GPU and the Hyper-V server. That's no longer the case with Server 2012. So you've got the ability to use RemoteFX off both Session Host and in a VDI instance without having a GPU in the Hyper-V server. Having said that, can I say the VMware? Yeah, whatever. Yep. Quite a few manufacturers now actually have GPU virtualization for VDI. Citrix with HDX 3D, VMware with the new CUDA-based NVIDIA GPU virtualization. You now have the ability of both Session Host and VDI to deliver full generic multimedia. The other thing that's happened... Actually, I'm not talking to the slides at all. I better do this.
Don't worry about it. Just keep going.
You got me onto...
Yeah.
Microsoft have actually done a hell of a lot of work to make VDI more relevant to the Microsoft environment. One of the things that they have done is you still need a bit of scripting to do automated VDI, but it's a hell of a lot easier at this point in time. And they're starting to pull things together. So you've got an integrated console for roles and everything else for publishing apps and desktops. And I guess in a way, they're at one level, if you look at things simplistically, Microsoft is starting to make third-party add-ons like Citrix and our own product, vWorkspace, a lot less relevant. But there's a catch to that. I'll mention that later.
I've got a covering slide at the end there to cover that off. Don't worry.
Okay. Virtual machine management has improved out of sight. SCVMM itself. Anybody here use SCVMM 2008.02? Did you like it?
I figured that, but there's only two hands going up.
Sorry.
To embarrass you guys. Don't worry.
Microsoft do actually listen to their customers, and from a virtual machine management viewpoint, there are a hell of a lot of improvements. Specifically, now you've got a lot more options in terms of user settings management, user profile management. Previously, you had two. Don't worry about roaming profiles, which was really great as long as you only had one session host or you didn't care what the users, what sort of environment the users got. And now what you've got is a very effective way of bundling all the user profile elements into user profile disk. It's not a perfect solution yet, but in terms of the inherent relatively greater efficiencies of block mode I/O to a linked or mounted VHD for both Session Host and VDI, Microsoft profile management has really improved out of sight.
Sorry.
Where did this one come from?
Hey,
okay. Storage is a big one. SMB3 is actually a really big deal. It's improved storage performance overall, to the extent where SMB3 has to be considered as a viable alternative to any of the other storage technologies that are being used. The important considerations with SMB3, of course, is that you have to have the appropriate clients at both ends. If you've got Windows XP going into Server 2012, you're still using SMB2, and you're still going to have the I/O issues and all that sort of thing. Network I/O has improved out of sight. You probably would have heard at the server virtualization or Hyper-V session that we can now, from a very practical sense, have something like anything up to 8 NICs, okay, 32 theoretical maximum, and Microsoft are getting throughputs, real throughputs, at 60 gigabits in that sort of scenario, operating system level teaming, which means that a lot of the I/O issues that you've traditionally had in desktop virtualization, VDI, etc., can be dealt with in a very much more elegant way, simply because you've got that much more throughput available. The other thing that snuck in with Server 2012 Hyper-V that's quite relevant to us is a working NFS client. Now, most of you will be probably aware that 2008.02, actually, the release candidate supported NFS, had an NFS client, and was actually dropped for the RTM release of 2008.02. So whatever existing storage infrastructure you've got, Server 2012 Hyper-V will talk to it. Okay. The reason I've spent a bit of time talking about Hyper-V is purely and simply that Hyper-V is actually a really good desktop virtualization hypervisor platform from a number of reasons. Traditionally, most companies at this point in time are probably using VMware in the back end if you're a larger customer. And it's important to make the separation between virtual desktop infrastructures and server virtualization infrastructures. And Hyper-V is not just good enough for virtual desktops. It is at least as good and probably superior to that other company in terms of delivering virtual desktops. And that's a big deal for you guys. It's a big change. And it needs a change in your mindset. Microsoft, with Server 2012 Hyper-V, and with the virtualization technologies and the storage enhancements, network throughput enhancements that they put into it, they not only have a viable alternative to VMware, I think they have an extremely powerful alternative to VMware, just to desktop virtualization.
Just as a quick show of hands, does everyone have VMware at the back end as well? I mean, I'm just asking the question, right?
Yeah.
Yep, so
kind of what we figured.
80-90%.
Okay. If you're looking at desktop virtualization and you haven't yet implemented it, Hyper-V isn't just good enough. It's right up there.
Is anyone considering, does anyone have Hyper-V in their environment today?
Rather less hands.
How many people are considering having Hyper-V in the next 12 months? Oh, looks like Microsoft's still got their work cut out.
Have a look at the capabilities. We can do some really sexy things around Hyper-V. We can provision machines faster than you can on VMware. At lower storage overheads, at lower network IO overheads and everything else. It is, if you're not considering Hyper-V, if you're considering desktop virtualization and you're not considering Hyper-V, you're cutting yourself a little bit short.
Just at it, and seeing as you're all being relatively interactive, and I appreciate that, I know lunch is usually a little bit, okay, dark room, let's go to sleep. Especially you lot up the back, okay, I'm sure. So just as a quick show of hands, okay, as far as Hyper-V, I guess I've lost my thread trying to throw a joke, right? Whoops. So Hyper-V is definitely the go, but one of the things that we touched on in the previous session is if you're going to do VDI or some form of desktop virtualization, and by that, let us just clarify, we don't care whether it's VDI or RDSH. As far as we're concerned, that's a method of getting the desktop to the user. If you're considering that, make absolutely certain, wherever possible, you get that into a different virtualization stack than the server virtualization. Okay? The reason why we say that and why we reiterate it a few times is your servers are, generally speaking, low CPU, not that intensive, and they sit there and they chug through things, right? They're a bit like a production line, and it just goes and goes and goes, and it doesn't really get up to much. From a desktop user perspective, it's bursty by nature. The people do things, then it has to carry up and catch up. Your IOPS are higher, your CPU is usually higher, your RAM needs to be dedicated, no overcommit. The rationale behind making sure that they're separate, if for some reason you do desktop virtualization and you end up in a situation where you have boot storms of some variety coming through there, can you think about how hard it's going to be if you've got no separation between all that? And you can't clearly identify desktop virtualization IOPS as opposed to server loads, you've really got a bit of an issue there. Especially if you've got someone breathing down your neck going, the finance department need to get the quality reports out now. You know, if that's not happening and you're under pressure and you can't separate it, you're really putting yourself in a bit of a bind there, okay? We appreciate that when you have small environments, sometimes you only have one virtualization stack and you've only got a certain amount of time, effort and energy around training, etc., and all of that. But please do be mindful. If you can keep a separation somehow with desktop and server loads, it'll pay off hugely in the end.
I guess, can we go back to that?
Oh, sorry.
Previous slide.
There you go.
The important thing to stress here is there, Microsoft, with probably the exception of EDA licensing, which is a bit ugly, Microsoft make no functional distinction now between virtual desktops hosted on single-user operating system instances and multi-user operating system instances. So basically, the delivery mechanisms you've got for session host, you've also got for VDI. And that's actually a big deal. You've got the same protocol capabilities, and you've got the same management mechanism, the same delivery mechanism for both types of virtual desktops.
Okay. So I guess just iterating again, as far as keeping server loads and desktop loads independent, the other nice thing comes together is if you can try and keep it to the pooled VM collection, the non-persistent, okay? This way there's a lot less overhead, a lot less administration overhead, keeps it very tidy. But at the same token, there is going to be instances, developers are one. So developers don't want... Actually, sorry, are there any developers in the room before we get any further? Okay, nobody's going to put their hand up anyway. So let's not get on a high horse anyway, but I think everyone in the room, if you're into this desktop infrastructure, which I'd imagine you are, otherwise you wouldn't be here, the point is we have to go and integrate and get this shit working that developers leave us with. So at the end of the day, look, if you can do pooled VMs and keep it persistent, one of the other things to remember as well is whether you're doing VDI or RDSH, you already have, with RDSH, you have access to AppV as well, okay? Now, AppV, does anyone use AppV, by the way? That's a fair degree. I mean, I'd sort of estimate it at about 20% or a little bit higher.
Well, let's challenge them. ThinApp?
That's a good point. Anyone use ThinApp? Now we have a very
Microsoft-centric
audience. Well done. Look, it is getting...
Just as a complete aside, why aren't you using AppV?
Actually, that's a very good call. Anyone?
If you're running session host...
There we go.
Yeah.
Sorry, what was the answer?
There's two things about AppV you've got to remember. Three things, actually. It can make your virtual desktop implementations a hell of a lot easier because it means your SOE, your base image, is a lot simpler. That's number one. Number two, if you're running session host and you're running session host 2008 or later, your RDS cal includes an AppV user license, AppV license. So it's not like if you're running session host, AppV isn't going to cost you any extra money unless you want to push it out to all your other desktops as well. The third thing that's really important is if you do go into application virtualization, make absolutely certain that you don't try to do that for all your applications. Because AppV is really, really good for a lot of applications, and it's really, really bad for others. Isolating your applications automatically means you're isolating them from other applications. So the inter-process communication and stuff like that gets a lot more complicated. But if you're running, if you're an accountancy firm and you're running seven different versions of MIOD or stuff like that, AppV can absolutely save your bacon. If you're not using it, you should at least consider using it. But for God's sake, don't ever take an attitude, we're going to virtualize all our applications, because all that's happening then is you're swapping one set of problems for another set of problems that actually can be far more interesting.
I've already done the slides, mate.
Oh, okay. If you guys read the slides while I'm talking, we can get through this really quickly. Personal VMs basically are persistent virtual machines. You've got to manage them the same way you manage your virtual servers. They've got to be available, so you've got to have high availability, you've got to have redundancy and everything else. It doesn't make sense to do that. Because what you're doing is you're moving desktops into the data center, and then you're managing the way you manage servers. They're desktops. They should be managed the way desktops are. No backups, nothing like that. Using non-personalized or using pooled virtual machines just makes so much sense. You don't have to care about them. They're very easy to manage. They've got a much lower storage increment and everything else. But, of course, you've got the issue of how do you make sure that the user has a consistent environment. And that's really where personalization with the user profile disk is nice. You can take all the stuff that normally represents the user environment and stick it on a VHD. And that VHD can be mounted as a drive on the user's virtual machine, or it can be linked off the network. So basically, it just looks like a network share.
Interestingly, the same sort of technology pieces come through time and time again. RDSH is really great for density, okay, and getting the most out of it, and yet it's not going to be for 100% of your organization or 100% of a particular user group. Okay, it's only going to get you so far. But the interesting thing is when you start rolling up the concept of using RDSH, then using pooled VDI, then personal VDI, and mixing in AppV with it, you can start to progress to the point where instead of hitting just 15 or 20% of your user base, you can expand that out to 30, 50, 60% plus. Okay? There are a number of areas there, but it does mean you have to progressively go through it. The interesting point, again, is pointed out here with user environment virtualization and file redirection, as well as the pooled disk as well, sorry, the profile disk, the same thing applies. Not always is it going to be appropriate, okay? But where you can, try and make it very simple and effective. The profile disk is more about bulk redirection, whereas file redirection is being able to selectively point bits and pieces of elements and send it off in different directions. It is very simple and easy and straightforward. If you've not tried it so far with Server 2012, the whole process about getting things up and running in a distributed environment is very slick. It's very easy to do. In fact, I was just, interestingly, as an aside, and I apologize because we keep, because we're techies, I hope you jump with us when we do a digression, but I was actually trying running a server last night on the Azure platform as well, very fast. Server 2012 managed to get it up and running in like less than 3 minutes, based out of Singapore, just from the hotel room here. Very simple, very easy, and very effective. The other technique that is worth remembering as well, with the way the Hyper-V works, it's not always that easy if you've just got a thumb drive and you want to plug something in it, etc., head in there. An interesting technique is just to go and create yourself, just like the user personal drive does, profile disk does, go and create yourself a VHD and put in it all your source code, all your tricks, all of the, Process Explorer and all of the sysinternals tools as well. Put it all in there and have it ready, and then you simply attach it as and when you need as you're building up devices. Makes it really slick and simple and easy just to get things going. If you have a server or a VDI that's not performing as well as it should, again, just pull this out in the storage, tap it into it, make it available, and then you've got your tool to be able to run. You've got your tools to run, but you've also got a great to put all your screenshots, etc., your logs, and then disconnect it and then go and check it out later. Okay. So I guess really just jumping through this and then heading off into the remote FX, do be aware that from the remote FX side of things, you do need to look at DirectX 11 hardware. Okay, they have ramped it up quite a bit. I haven't seen much of this sort of change too much recently, but it's very interesting to see how intense it can be. There's certainly elements from both Dell and HP and people like that where you've got big graphics cards being able to be put into chassis with blade servers, etc., and things like that.
If you're stuck with OpenGL applications, then RemoteFX isn't actually going to be good for you. Then you've got to consider something like HP's RGS protocol, Vue's 5.1's new NVIDIA GPU offloading, and stuff like Citrix 3D HDX 3D. But for DirectX applications, the efficiency of the GPU utilization is actually pretty darn good in RemoteFX.
Now, I will call out as well, I don't know that I've actually been told off for it yet because I don't think anyone noticed the typo in here, but apparently now it's not called Metro UI. I believe, I think that's a rumor, so I probably better not repeat it. But I was told by one of the Microsoft chaps up at the Dell conference. Sorry? Is it?
And modern.
It's
Windows
8
UI.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I think it was a German.
I actually picked that up when I was editing the slides, and Dave wanted to leave it.
Pointed out in the last sort of hour or so. We were actually joking last week. We were saying, well, it is the UI that used to be so recently named Metro, if you like, so to use a bit of Monty Python. But we digress. But the nice thing is it takes all of that user interface that you're going to see on the tablets, certainly on the Surface and that side of things, and it brings it straight into what you're able to do. I was actually questioned by, my brother actually works in the same industry, but back down in Canberra, and he's actually sort of started to challenge me to a certain extent that both with Quest, with what we have with vWorkspace and Citrix, are we still going to be relevant? Because what he pointed out is with the release of the Surface, if you've got a holistic Windows and Microsoft-based environment where you've got your tablet, you've got your phone, you've got your laptop, you've got your PC, you've got your remote desktop, is it relevant anymore for all of this third-party pieces to glue it all together? Okay. It's actually, just as a show of hands, who has an iPad or an iPhone? Yeah.
Who's running Windows 8? Congratulations.
Oh, crikey. All right. Microsoft don't count.
Okay, the reason I say that is RemoteFX 8, really it's RemoteFX 2, but RDP 8, except RDP 8 isn't RDP anymore, will only work if you've got Windows 8 at one end and Windows 8 or Session Host 2012 at the other. There's no backward compatibility. It's a little bit like the what used to be Metro interface. Okay, you don't like it, tough. Microsoft made the decision that they're going to move us forward. If you want all the capabilities of RemoteFX that comes with 2012 and Windows 8, you better have Windows 8 at the client end. I think that's possibly going to be a little bit of a hiccup, but we'll talk about the protocols a bit later.
To be honest, with the Metro UI, I must confess I was not a big fan to start with. Absolutely, and I don't mean that badly, all right, but that's the way it was. But we sat through a session where we had one of the Microsoft chaps cover an hour on the Metro, what was recently called Metro, for
Windows
an hour.
8.
And we sat through the same session for 4 days. And even not having used it, watching him demonstrate it for an hour, four times, and I'm not saying that's an effective use of any of your time, okay, because we all know, bloody hell, we've got enough to do with less anyway. But the point was, after only 4 hours, it became very intuitive just watching it and seeing how it works, okay. I don't think it's as big as and scary as what I thought it was probably 4 to 6 weeks ago. And certainly, the thing is, I think anyone, you know, and I'm not, well, I'm the last one to be ageist, right? Either of us, to be honest. But anyone who's probably under the age of 25-ish, give or take, will take to this like a duck to water. I don't know if anyone's got young children, but if you've seen kids of 2 or 3, okay, and I think there's been a recent demonstration with a YouTube video, the woman puts an iPad in front of the child and then takes that away and puts a magazine. And the child's going, it's broken. What's going on? So, you know, and it's amazing. It's an amazing change. Okay, so it is quite a transition, but suck it up. Suck it up and get on board, because I think it is going to be quite amazing. We were told, and this was the question that probably all of you want to ask anyway, and certainly it was in those sessions that we had, everyone to a man wanted to have 3-4 goes at, can I replace Metro with a start button? And the answer is no. Okay, that was a very emphatic no. I don't know, is that maybe someone from Microsoft might want to... Okay, there is no way it's going to change. Get used to it. Go with it. Okay.
But the thing about RemoteFX on Windows 8, if you're using a Windows 8 client, is it will deliver you everything. You've got full touch capability, multi-touch, everything else. And it's worth having a look at. It's actually quite interesting what Microsoft
has done. Worth having a look at. Look, it's some of the details, and I've The slide after this just covers off in a bit more detail, because this was very, very recent, but we'll just sort of cover off on this. There are some group policies, etc. A lot of these haven't been fully articulated, or we haven't been able to fully articulate them yet. They've only been very, very recent. Okay, but do be aware that there is plenty of performance counters, etc., to be able to monitor the information of how this works. Now, I apologise in advance that these are very long URLs, okay? But these are the last three that, if you haven't seen them, have come through from the RDS blog, I should say, okay? Remote Desktop Services blog. These are so relevant. They're so relevant for a real deep dive on a lot of the hard work that's gone into the back of making Remote FX really, really relevant, okay? At a quick glance, just a quick glance through this, you have to say to yourself, this basically puts the sword straight up to PC over IP, okay? And to a certain extent, even from the early bits that we're hearing from Teradici around PC over IP, yes, they're going to have RDSH, but to be honest, this is new water for them anyway, and I really don't see that sort of making ground.
Mind you, in a very real sense, it justifies PC over IP as well, because we've long criticised PC over IP because it uses UDP on the WAN. And, yeah, everybody knows UDP on the WAN is crap. Provided your error rates are low enough...
Rick, hang on a second. Not everybody understands.
Oh,
so
sorry.
At the risk... I will apologise in advance beforehand, but Rick will get passionate and will diverge on this, but I take it this is of interest. Yeah? So expand a little bit on the UDP is
okay.
On a WAN.
Please. UDP is what was designed as a LAN-only protocol because it makes some assumptions. The assumptions it makes is it's got as much bandwidth as it needs. The assumption is the packets will get to the other end without error. So all the overhead that you've got with TCP in terms of packet acknowledgements, sliding window protocol, communications and all that sort of thing, that stuff's all gone. In fact, you can see it on the slide up here. Here we are, the very bottom one. I'm not very good at pointing. Hang on, there's a pointer in that, I think.
Oh, sorry, mate. Go for it. Should be that red button, I think. Try not to point it at the audience.
So here's our LAN. Yeah, I know, but if I pointed that, they won't be able to see the red dot. Here's our LAN protocol.
I'll give you a TIFX marker in a minute.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. And what you can see is there is UDP throughput and there is TCP throughput. You can see there's quite a difference. On the LAN, UDP just runs rings around TCP. Now, the impressive thing is up until we get up to about 200 milliseconds, in fact, right up, UDP still runs rings around TCP. Now, there's some gotchas.
As always.
UDP streams don't like sharing bandwidth. So if you've got 10 people in a remote office sitting on a 4 or 10 megabit link, and they're all running UDP sessions, you're going to have a headache because they're going to get in each other's way. UDP doesn't understand the concept of, whoa, hang on a second, somebody else has got to go through. But on a dedicated link, or if you've got an appropriate WAN accelerator that can actually handle UDP, UDP blows TCP out of the water. Now, we cheat a little bit, and this is where I throw in some marketing. There are other ways of getting this sort of thing. I mean, for example, we've got a multi-session TCP engine, RDP proxy, that goes a long way towards removing those problems. This slide really is just a reflection of that one, insofar as what we're seeing here is basically how much information gets queued up when you're running UDP and when you're running TCP as the latency goes up. This, prior to RDP 8, sorry, Remote FX 8, Microsoft had a very interesting bandwidth regulating technology, which I call jokingly queue and toss. And the reason I say jokingly is when the queue is full, toss frames. Okay, so prior to Remote FX 8, what you actually saw was this stuff just got dumped. So if you're watching a video over Remote FX 7, as the latency went up, you started losing huge chunks of the video, so it got very jumpy. What they've done with Remote FX 8 is it actually does proper cue and toss. So you're not losing frames. What you're doing instead is redisplaying frames at the other end and actually not sending the bandwidth across the network. So some huge differences in the protocol, but really what this outlines is as latency goes up, TCP can really stop up. How many of you know what sliding window protocol is? A few. Okay. It's basically a way of sending many more packets without an acknowledgement. The problem is typically if you're using WAN analyzer with sliding window protocol, you'll see the bandwidth utilization stop up and then suddenly bump back down again and up and down. So what I'm saying in a really roundabout way is provided your WAN infrastructure is good enough, UDP actually isn't such a bad deal. So despite the fact that we used to say that VMware were nuts with PC over IP, maybe they're not nuts.
Is it fair to say, though, Rick, that this is going to provide a really great experience, but so far everything we've seen so far is effectively in single-use mode, in that it'll give you a high fidelity, but there is not necessarily any fair share of sharing the bandwidth?
Absolutely not. There's no fair share with UDP. Single-user connections, UDP is fantastic. Multi-user connections over the same link, you're better off using TCP. Sorry?
What's your view on using UDP for quality of service?
There's some interesting technology out there for handling UDP. There's a WAN accelerator from a company called Silver Peak, for example, where what they're doing is essentially giving a network RAID, if you like, insofar as they can give you an error-free UDP connection. And they're essentially doing packet replication and stuff like that on a sideband. UDP, you can't have a traffic cop in the way, basically, with UDP, unless you're doing some smarts. So if you haven't got a technology like Silver Peak, on the LAN, this technology is brilliant. If you've only got 20, 30 milliseconds latency, it's brilliant. If you're looking at 200 to 300 milliseconds, you're better off with TCP. And that's really why Microsoft also give you the ability to arbitrarily select UDP or TCP for a given set of users with group policies.
And it's worth noting that there is like mechanisms in there, not just at login, and that's traditionally what has been the case. At login, there's either a manual check from the user that says, I'm on about this sort of protocol, you know, or this sort of connection speed, therefore I'm going to get this sort of capability built into it. Now it's checking it on a regular basis as well, okay? So it's definitely a vast improvement. We'd even like to think that certainly with not so much from ourselves, but certainly some of the rest of the Quest team, we'd like to think that we can help make this even better further down the track and add some value. But as it stands right now, I think the reality of what we've seen so far is remote FX is definitely right up there with PC over IP. And I think the suggestion there is why would you bother going and trying another third party when you can just use the native tools and get it in there? The caveats will probably come back to the fact that you do need Windows 8 and RDSH 2012 or Win8 at the back end. Okay, so there is some detail here in the slide deck which we'll go through as far as how those numbers are calculated. I don't like to apologise in advance, but at the same token, we haven't had enough time and effort to be able to stand this up and run through this in really big numbers. There are a number of different usage cases we can think where we'd like to analyse it a lot better and get some real-world examples, because I think these are going to be absolutely relevant sooner rather than later, certainly with the take-up. In the past, to a certain extent, we would always advocate that you use RDSH for density and or for cost benefits, and then only go to VDI for exceptions. Some of those exceptions would typically be around USB devices. Okay? As soon as you need USB devices that are not drive maps or not printers, etc., things like that, then it almost became a ubiquitous question of going, right, let's go straight across to VDI for this because it just makes a lot more sense. Now that we've actually got that sorted out in RDSH so that you can actually interrogate and keep each user session separate, this becomes less of an issue, okay? Having said that, and at the risk of letting Rick diverging in.
Oh, no, not a divergence at all. I just wanted to say there's something really important on the top line of this slide.
Oh, sorry.
You must read it. It says remote FX USB device redirection, not USB bus redirection. If you redirect the USB bus over a WAN connection, you've just bought yourself a bucket load of problems. Because USB devices don't understand the concept of latency. But remote FX USB device redirection, that's basically higher level redirection, okay? You've got a Windows host, you've got a Windows machine here, you've got a Windows machine here. We're using Windows image acquisition drivers instead of using USB drivers to redirect that USB device. So you're actually going to need drivers at the client end and the appropriate stuff at the other end to do this. But it's a hell of a lot more bandwidth efficient. And it can stand latency. Because if I'm doing isochronous, if I'm doing webcam redirection, at a USB bus level, I'm sending data as fast as I can. That doesn't translate very well onto the WAN. And in fact, the driver at the other end is expecting a continuous stream of data. Whereas if I'm doing it with Windows image acquisition, I can adjust the frame rate appropriate to the bandwidth. I can adjust the frame rate, the actual image resolution appropriate to the bandwidth and everything else. This is really why I've spent a little bit of time on this. We typically fall across the problem that people say, oh, I want to redirect a USB device. Okay, that's fine. But don't try and redirect the USB bus traffic.
Another interesting point, and this comes back to those three links as well from the Remote Desktop Services blog, just pointing out the telephone unit there. It's clearly not a Cisco unit, but then that's interesting as well. Recently, we've been looking at some details around some of the Cisco units and how they're basically the VXC and the VXI, and how that doesn't mean that you have to go back to the data center and back out again to be able to do VoIP, okay, whether it be webcam, VoIP, etc. Now, the interesting thing is there is a link in there that goes into a bit more detail about how this works with Link and Remote FX. The real nice part is you've got the same mechanism coming through there now. Again, haven't had enough to dive into it really deep. Would love to be able to set up a demo environment for next week at the Gold Coast, but I don't think it's going to happen. But the reality is you can now start looking at your VoIP traffic, and that includes your webcam side of things, being point to point and not having to do a quick round robin back to the data center. You can imagine the point when I'm in a branch office and all I want to do is have a session to someone in the other part of the campus, you know, and then all of my traffic now, including webcam traffic, has to go back to headquarters at some other metro or, you know, interstate office, and then has to come all the way back again. It's totally and wholly inappropriate. But now with the link mechanism, there's the ability to go point to point directly between you and the user, keep it all LAN, keep it all central. Now, it's not going to address everything, and certainly with some of the elements we've covered off with vWorkspace, we can help make link audio be WAN friendly as well. So there's ways and means about getting around to it, but again, without sort of jumping back to the original session we had earlier, keep it simple, okay? Keep your designs simple, keep them relevant, and make them bang for the buck for the most of the people in the organization. So I guess just sort of recapping as far as some elements of the technology, various bits and pieces come into play, but definitely we're looking at the idea of the session host being the most scalable, the most cost effective, and that should pretty much be that first element or that first bite of what you're looking at. Make that the default approach. Then when you have exceptions, you start moving on to pooled VDI where it makes sense, and then if you have to, go down to personal VDI sessions as well. Anything more particular to add at this point?
Not really. I mean, the personal VMs is basically giving the user their own virtual machine. Sounds really easy. It is really easy. It will cost you a lot of money. Simple as that. Pooled VMs ought to be the way you go. Purely and simply because you're reducing your storage overhead, you're increasing your security significantly. If the user does something stupid, they download something to the machine reverts on log off. That's a big deal. Session hosts, okay, We've talked about where VDI and session host basically fall. Session host, look, with the advent of AppV, with the use of application compatibility tools, application compatibility shims, etc., you can probably get 85, 90, 95% of applications going on a session host. But after that first 80% or so, things get harder.
And in all fairness, though, Rick, that's you getting all those apps.
Yeah, I know.
95% of
apps. Okay, I'm anal about that.
Okay.
AppV makes that whole scenario a lot easier. But VDI makes it easier yet. I don't have to worry about the fact that the application's writing user data into the application binary folder, and that's going to share the way that's going to share, you know, create sharing problems and all that sort of thing. With VDI, VDI is undoubtedly easier. VDI is undoubtedly more expensive. So, but the one thing, the message from this is really, unless you've got a really, really, really good reason for pushing out personal VMs, if pooled VMs are 2 to 3 times more expensive than session host, personal VMs are probably 5 or 10 times more expensive than session host. So you really have to think about that. Okay. The easy path is not the most cost-effective one.
So just recapping to a certain extent, as my brother's even challenged me on, I think that's a little bit disappointing coming from my brother. I will have to call him on that. But then having said that, he does invite me down to the odd occasion, so I have to forgive him a few transgressions. But Citrix and Quest and or VMware View, there is still going to be elements of that. I'd say less of the view, because really the point they had to make was it's only VDI. That's certainly, we are biased, okay, because VWorkspace just works VDI and RDSH, it's all in the same management console. But it's always been a bugbear that with Vue's approach, it's VDI only. And to be honest, that's such a costly affair of how, having traveled that path. But I don't think Citrix and Quest are going away anytime soon, because you're going to have, for quite a while, you're going to have XP, Win 7, as well as Server 2008 R2, as well as, dare I say it, some Server 2003. There is going to be elements of that. And until you get them on board with that, okay, with to Win 8, okay, this is not necessarily going to apply. Having said that, I'm genuinely excited about where we're getting to as far as the protocol stacks, the ability. Look, the installation routine on this alone is just really nice and slick. It's a far cry from where we were, well, without showing too much age, but 10, 15 years ago. It is absolutely amazing. So if you need mixed support, etc., if you need some complex load balancing at those back ends, if you need, in fact, to be honest, I think it's almost fair to say that if you need universal print mechanisms, even in 2012 Win 8, there's elements where there's going to be a piece to hand for there. So what we would like to do is just point out for a couple of takeaways, we do have a free VDI assessment tool. It should probably be more rightly called a desktop infrastructure assessment tool, to be honest. It's quite comprehensive based on the Liquidware Labs, so more than happy to help with that. We did have our emails up on the start of the slide deck, and you'll get those later as well. If folks are getting stalled with migrating from XP to Win 7, do have a think about checking out the ChangeBase product again, because that can certainly help accelerate things. We've certainly got a couple of large financials in Sydney, over in Australia at the moment, that do appear to be like ostriches with their head in the sand and not going forwards because it's too hard. This is a tool that will make it easy and make it a lot easier to go forward. And I guess with that, I think we're pretty much bang on. Has anyone got any questions?
Well, I'd like to make a couple of closing comments. And they're really re-emphasizing what I said earlier. If you are not considering looking at Server 2012 Hyper-V, you should. The ability to be able to do active migration from across non-clustered volumes, basically from one data store on one Hyper-V server to another, the replication capabilities and that sort of thing, they will have a huge impact on the scalability and the efficiency of your virtual desktop infrastructure. All the stuff we've said about RemoteFX 8 is really exciting, but Dave's really touched on, and I have to some extent too, If you want to use RemoteFX 8, it's going to be Windows 8 at one end, Server 2012, Windows 8 at the other. So that's probably not going to happen for a while. You can use RemoteFX 7 right now. You can deliver RDP and RemoteFX 7 to a large number of non-Windows devices. Your iPads, your iPhones, Android tablets, Linux, Java, etc. Okay? That's the stuff, really. Microsoft are very much concentrate on Windows, and I think they've done a fantastic job on the server side of things. On the desktop side of things, really, they're very focused on getting you up to Windows 8. They've got a lot of carrots for you. But if you're not interested in running Windows 8 yet, you still will be looking at third-party solutions on top of Windows.
Okay. Thanks very much, folks. Anyone got any questions? Or do you just want to take questions off? We'll be around for another hour or so anyway. Happy to take any questions. Thank you very much for your attention, folks, and a big shout out to Microsoft for Server 2012. It's looking awesome. All right. Thank you very much.